earlier this year, I went over to St. Mark's Church on the other side of town to take a midweek communion service in the absence at that time of their vicar. And it was all very straightforward. I began by saying how nice it was to be with them and thank you for their welcome and so on. And I led the service. I stayed around afterwards to chat to those who had come. And it was all very pleasant. And then one of them said, "Well, thank you, but who are you?" I was surprised. I assumed they knew. I assumed that someone had told them who it was who would be coming to take the service that evening in the absence of the vicar. It was slightly embarrassing to be asked that question when it was all over. Suppose that I'd reacted not with surprise but with shock and said, "Don't you know? Do you really not know who I am? You should. It's very, very important. In fact, working out who I am is the most important thing you could ever do. It's far more important to think about that than all the other things your mind has been full of today. In fact, the only thing that really matters in this life is that you should come to understand who I am and adjust your whole life and its direction in the light of your discovery." Well, I admit a little bit of me would rather like to have said that just to gauge their reaction. Actually, it would have been quite interesting to see what they would have thought. But of course, who I was and am is totally irrelevant. In case you don't know this morning, I'm Giles, I'm the vicar here. I'll just get that one clear. But it was very polite of them to ask, but they didn't really need to. And when they did find out who I was, I have to say that the impact on their life was less than revolutionary. But not so with Jesus. As we have seen, if you've been looking at Mark's Gospel with us over these Sundays, this is the question to which everything else in the Gospel record points. Who is this man? And in the section that Jenny's just read to us, Peter the disciple gets it right at last. The penny finally drops. Till then, like most people, he has been intrigued and impressed by this Jesus whom he's been following for some time. But only at this point does he understand who he is. Only at this point does he recognize his uniqueness. He recognizes that this Jesus is not just one among many. He's not even the greatest. He is the only. He's in a category all of his own, and he's not to be identified by comparing him with great names from the past. So far, so good. Verse 29, "Who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are Christ, God's chosen and anointed king." But what he does not yet understand is the implications of his discovery. He does not yet understand what this will mean for him personally. In fact, he's worse than clueless. He seems to think that he's now on a roll, that Jesus' cause is going to be triumphant. This is, after all, the promised Messiah. And Messiahs win things, they deliver people. And so Peter is going to share in that triumph of the Christ. And how else could it be, given this man is God's chosen king? Well, the Christ will indeed be triumphant. But what Peter does not yet understand, that though his cause will not fail, the way to glory is the way of the cross. That is the point he's not yet grasped. This is how it will be for Jesus. Verse 31, "He began to teach them that the Son of Man must, not just will, but must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again." And he said this plainly. It's how it will be for Jesus. It is also how it will be for those who follow Jesus, because he asks a cross for a cross. So let's look carefully together at this short paragraph, which takes us to the core, really, to the heart of what it means to be a Christian in 2016. And the first thing that we find here is an open invitation from Jesus. And it's an unusual one, because it's an invitation to come and die. Every now and again, Sarah and I receive an invitation, and usually on a nice card of some kind, to a wedding or a celebration of something. And when we get an invitation like that, we're pleased, and we may well put it on the mantelpiece. We like to look at it. It's very nice to be invited to this, whatever it is, and we like to be reminded of it. But if the invitation card said, "Not come and dine with us, but please come and die with us," I think we would think twice about putting it on the mantelpiece, because it doesn't sound like a lot of fun. But that is what's on offer in verse 34. He called to him the crowd with his disciples and said to them, If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. The picture here is of a person condemned to death by crucifixion, and such a person would often be compelled to carry not the whole cross, but the horizontal part, the cross beam. And as he stumbled along with this thing across his back, and with soldiers on either side, everybody watching would know where he was heading. It was crystal clear. And the invitation to take up your cross is an invitation to a kind of dying with Jesus. A year or so ago, after our main morning service here on a Sunday, we held a baptism service for a little chap, Sebastian, I think, whose family have since moved away, not with us now. Sebastian's mum and dad were in their late 20s, I should think, and a lot of their friends came down from London and elsewhere to join us for the occasion, about 60 of their friends, I suspect, almost all at the same stage of life, but very few of them had babies or children of their own. It was a fairly professional bunch. You could tell they weren't used to being in church because they'd all dressed up for the occasion. And we came to the point in the service where these words of Jesus are referred to. And so before taking baby Sebastian and exhorting him to deny himself and take up his cross and follow, I addressed the gathered throng and just made the point that being a Christian, following Jesus in this world is hard. It's a tough call. It is not for the cowardly or the faint-hearted. And a few more words along those lines. Now, no one amongst the 60 friends present actually stood up to contradict me, but I could tell from their faces they didn't believe a word of it. The unspoken reaction to my words was, come off it. This is a nice and a pretty little occasion. But we live, unlike you, in the real world. And who needs religion there? And their answer was, the people who need religion in the real world are the no-copers, precisely the cowardly and the faint-hearted who can't cope without a crutch. But you see, what Jesus offered is not a crutch, but a cross. And it's an invitation to take it up and to die. Going his way is going to be tough. Let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow. Two elements there. First, let him deny himself. And that is a very radical and difficult thing to do. Now, later in the narrative, and it comes over very powerfully in the way it's performed in the Mark drama, later in the narrative of Mark's Gospel, we come to the famous incident when Peter loses his nerve. And despite everything he's promised beforehand, he denies all association with Jesus. Confronted by a servant girl, he begins to curse and to swear and to say, I do not know the man. I do not know the man. And that's really what this means. To deny is to say no. And to deny yourself is going very much deeper than denying yourself things. People misunderstand that sometimes. It's easy enough to go without chocolate or something. Well, maybe quite hard actually, but you know what I mean. It's relatively easy to go without chocolate if you're a chocolate lover. But to deny yourself is different from denying yourself something. And Jesus says it is your very self that you're going to have to deny if you're going to follow me. It's as if your life is like a car in which you have till now been the driver. And now you've got to move over into the passenger seat and let Jesus have the controls. And to decide to do that is difficult because each of us likes to be the driver and to have control. To decide where we're going, what route we're going to take, what speed, and so on. None of us likes to let go of the controls. A friend of mine was once explaining this point to a young inquirer who happened to be an American. I was trying to get him to see that to become a Christian was to move out of the center of the picture and over to the side, and to remain there with Jesus occupying the central place. And he explained this at some length and very clearly, and the young man became very thoughtful. And then he said, gee, I guess I'm not too keen on this decentralization. Which is a very good word to use. To deny yourself is about decentralization. It's about moving out of the center so that Jesus can move in. Now, you'll know that providers of credit cards are obliged by law to publish the APR. You're familiar with those three letters? The annual percentage rate of interest, so that all is out in the open, no small print, and it's 18.9% or whatever if you go for this card. Now, there is an equivalent APR for the Christian. with each letter standing for a significant part of life. A for ambitions, P for possessions, R for relationships. And all three areas are to come under the authority of Jesus. All natural human ambitions, that's the A, are to be laid at his feet, to be reshaped at his direction. And that's ambition for yourself and, of course, for your children, if you have them. You can tell what somebody really wants in life if you ask them not what they want for themselves, but what they want for their children. And then P, all possessions, meaning your home, your income, your assets, all material things are to belong to him from now on, to be used or to be given away as he sees fit. And then there's the R for relationships, and all relationships, sexual and other, are now to conform to his standards rather than those of personal preference or of lifestyle choice. See, this is a big demand. The APR, all out in the open, no small print. And in all such things, the attitude from now on is going to be, Lord Jesus, not what I want, but what you want, both for me and from me. Now, shortly before his arrest and crucifixion, Jesus himself prayed along such lines to his heavenly Father. Father, not what I want, but what you want. And he only asks of us what he himself has already done, and at a greater cost by far than you or I will ever be asked to pay. So that's the first phrase, let him deny himself. And it's followed by the second, let him take up his cross and follow. And what for Jesus was a literal physical experience is to be replicated symbolically in yours and mine. No one carrying a cross had any future that he could call his own. And to say that we must take up our cross is to say that following Jesus is to be done publicly. No one was ever crucified in private. It was a very public thing, and you cannot be a secret disciple restricting your Christian commitment to Sunday attendance or to what happens behind closed doors. And further, if you're going to follow Jesus, you've got to be ready to be unpopular in this world. And we need never to forget that when the most gracious, the most admirable, the most loving of men appeared on this earth, we rose up and put him to death. That's the historical fact. Human darkness rose up and extinguished the light. And it would have happened today every bit as easily as it did then. And followers of Jesus should not expect to be thanked and to be approved of and to be admired for doing so. He asks a cross for a cross. If the world hates you, he said on another occasion, remember that it hated me first. Now that hostility may be relatively trivial for some of us, that pitiful look, the gentle ribbing of colleagues who just think you're weird for going to church and a Bible study, or think you're odd for not joining in their revelries, or for giving up your summer holiday to help wash up on a Christian camp. I mean, honestly. But it may take more serious form. In our context, it might mean being passed over promotion or even losing your job. In other parts of the world, it will mean losing your life. An African pastor, I think a Nigerian, was worried recently about the risks he was taking for himself and his family by his open following Jesus, but he was reminded by a wise friend that he was going to die sometime in any case, and so the important thing was to be found doing the right thing when that time came. So however this works out in practice, we may be absolutely sure that there is a cost, a price to be paid in accepting Jesus' invitation, and the cost is both internal and external, both in terms of what you yourself must do in self-denial, and what others may do to you as you take up your cross. There is an internal and an external aspect to discipleship, and both are critical. What you must do and what you must expect others to do to you. And it's all out in the open. It's an invitation to die. But, and this is very wonderful, it is at the same time an invitation to live. See what he goes on to say in verse 35. Having said, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow, he then says, whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's, will save it. And what does he mean by this? Well, to save your life is to insist on retaining control of it, to remain in that driving seat, and to resist the call to decentralize. It's to hang on to the controls. That's what he means by wanting to save your life. So in terms of the APR again, the person who wants to save their life will think along these lines. My ambitions, what I want to do with my life, that's all up to me. Whether there's much of life left or very little, it's mine, and I make my own plans. Nobody else makes them for me. And my possessions, likewise, are my own. My house, my assets, my income, they're all mine or ours, perhaps, and no one else tells me or us what to do with the money that I earn or have. And as for relationships, well, that's a very personal matter. Please don't try to impose immorality on me. One size does not fit all. We work out our own attitude to such things these days. And as long as no one else is hurt, then live and let live. Let tolerance rule. Now, there's nothing unusual in those attitudes. Broadly speaking, it's where most people are at, with variations, of course. You'll recognize them in the people you rub shoulders with day by day. May even be that you listening this morning recognize them in yourself. Maybe it's where you're at today in terms of the APR. And it's what Jesus is referring to by his talking about wanting to save your life. And what he wants us to understand is that that attempt is doomed to failure. It simply cannot work. Whoever would save his life, says Jesus, will lose it. And the plain fact is that we are mortal. It is the ultimate statistic, isn't it, that one out of one dies. And if before that day you thought you were in control of your life, you will realize at that point that you were wrong all along. Nobody's in control of their life at that point. And in this present state, none of us is really in control of our lives, if we're honest and realistic, even if we manage to persuade ourselves that we are. All of us are susceptible to factors and to forces that are entirely outside our control. We don't know, do we, when illness may suddenly strike, or a business go under, or a relationship suddenly turns sour, come to grief. These things come from nowhere. And we were never meant to live with this delusion that we are actually in control of our lives. It humbles us, but it is true. And to try to live as if we are, to hold on to life as mine, is the guaranteed route, says Jesus, to failure. It will never work. Whoever would save his life will lose it. But there is a better way to go, an infinitely better way, because by submitting to Jesus, by letting him have the control, by committing ourselves to his cause, we find life, the life that has always eluded us to that point. And you'll find yourself saying yes as I say those words, if you're a believer in Jesus this morning. You find yourself saying, this makes the most marvelous sense. For the first time ever, I'm truly free. I know why I'm here. I could never see it before. I was always restless underneath, always dissatisfied, even when life was good. Always feeling that even so, that things never quite lived up to their promise. But now I find that this promise, the one Jesus makes, is wonderfully, fabulously true. I've let go of my life for him and his gospel. And it's a bit like a boomerang. I've thrown it away and I find it's come zooming back again. Much more wonderfully before. In fact, I haven't really lost anything. It's all gain and no loss. There's an old prayer book saying, from the old Church of England prayer book, says of Jesus that his service is perfect freedom. Well, that encapsulates it well. This world, this life, and eternity all belong to him. It's what we mean when we say Jesus is Lord. It all belongs to him, and so if my life is in his hands, I cannot lose. So this is a genuinely open invitation, an invitation to die in order to live. Everything's out in the open, and there's no small print, which is very different from my insurance policy that I took out on our 12-year-old Ford KA earlier this summer. Earlier this summer, a rather larger car ran into our rather small KA. The larger car wasn't going at all fast. I mean, it didn't need to be in order to put the KA beyond repair, economically. The insurance company sent us a rather small check, which is what they decided the car was worth. And I was then looking forward to getting another check, a rather larger one, as a refund of the remaining insurance premium. I mean, I'd insured it in June at considerable cost so that our 22-year-old son could drive it. I'd insured it in June. The accident happened in July. Well, that's clear then, isn't it? It should mean a nice, substantial check by way of refund for the remaining months. But it never came. What did come was a letter from the insurance company all about procedures. I turned over to the page, the top of page 2, and read these words. In accordance with the terms of the policy, there will be no refund of the outstanding premium. I thought that's downright mean. But I couldn't complain. It had been there all along in the small print. But I doubt that I ever read the small print. I couldn't blame anybody except myself. But that's how the world operates, isn't it? It trumpets what it has to give, but it keeps very, very quiet about what it will keep or take away. That's not how Jesus operates. It's all utterly out in the open. The cost of following is something he makes very, very plain. Deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow. But the cost of not following is something he makes equally plain. And that cost is underlined in what he goes on to say by an unanswerable question and a sobering prospect. The unanswerable question comes in verse 36, where he says, "What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his life?" So at this point, Jesus is really saying we should go in for a simple cost-benefit analysis. That's all. According to Wikipedia, which came to my help, cost-benefit analysis has two purposes. First of all, to determine whether something is a sound decision or an investment. And secondly, to enable you to compare the total expected cost of each option against the total expected benefits, to see whether the benefits outweigh the costs, and if so, by how much. Well, here is the person in Jesus' mind who has got there. They've made a success of life. In fact, this person seems to gain the whole world. Meaning they've made a success of life, as most people would understand it. They've achieved everything they've ever aimed at. They've acquired everything they've ever wanted. Well, that would appeal to young people today. It's a very common, it's the commonest ambition in surveys among young people today. They want to be rich. So here is the person who's achieved everything they've ever aimed at and acquired everything they've ever wanted. Now, not many people can look back over their lives and say that. A few probably can and arouse the envy of others in doing so. And their success is very impressive. I mean, look at it. It fills the newspapers and documentaries. But at the end of the day, the question over it all that Jesus asks is, so what? So what? What was it all for? And maybe they never even paused long enough to ask that simple question. What was it all for? One man was telling a friend about the death of a third person who was known for his considerable wealth. "Died, has he?" said the other. "Wow. Did he leave a lot?" "Oh yes," said his friend, "he left it all." And it would surely be disastrous, wouldn't it, to achieve everything you've ever aimed at, only to find at the end that all through your life you've been aiming at the wrong things. And therefore to have no answer when Jesus asks you what you did with his invitation, when it came your way, and when you had every opportunity to respond. Now that is the sobering prospect that he holds out for us in verse 38. "For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." Extraordinary words. Because this is a man who is heading to his death, who is going to be crucified in weakness, but who says almost in the same breath that he will also return one day in glory. Now, for those who've lived for him, surrendered life to him, that will be the greatest of days. But how does that prospect seem to you today? It is so very easy in the here and now just to be ashamed of Jesus, to say maybe this whole Christian thing is just too embarrassing, it's too uncool, it's too culturally alien for me to sign up and be known as one of them. It's all very interesting, and in fact at times I find it quite persuasive, and I do see that it's great for you, but I don't really think it's going to be for me. And it's so easy to take that line, which is why so many people do. I just hope that you listening this morning are not one of them. Because Jesus asks us to think, and so many never get round to thinking. He asks us to think, to consider what he says, and to weigh up the alternatives. He really could not put it more plainly. Whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. And there is no third alternative. You're either in one place or the other. So there's an initial decision to take, which he's calling us to. And after that, a daily attitude to maintain of self-denial, taking up the cross and following. And as someone once memorably said, he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose.